Migration is a subject that's never far from the headlines, whether it's debates about borders, workers, or questions of belonging and identity. But behind the politics and the statistics are human stories. Stories about what it actually means to leave home and build a life somewhere new, something Irish people know a lot about. Louise Ryan, Senior Professor of Sociology at London Metropolitan University, has researched this subject for decades. She's a leading expert on migration and social networks, how people move across countries and how they build relationships, support systems and communities from scratch in unfamiliar places. Her work has explored the experiences of migrants from all over the world, Irish, Polish, Caribbean, African, and how they built their lives in London, creating new networks, friendships and support systems along the way. And Louise joins me now. You're very welcome indeed to The History Show, Louise.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, you first began this research back in the early 2000s, talking to older Irish women migrants about their experiences emigrating to London as far back as the 1930s. But the idea of networks quickly took hold as the key theme, I think, in this research. Explain to us this idea of networks and what it means in the context of migration.
Well, I've always been fascinated by relationships between people. And I think one of the challenges with understanding migration is that it's often researched at a very macro level, by which I mean at a very broad and wide level in terms of tens of thousands or millions of people moving in waves from one country to another, people in very large numbers moving across borders. Or at the other end of the scale, migration is often researched at a kind of individual level, like the kind of single economic actor moving from one country to another to improve their life chances. But both of those scales, the macro and the more micro, kind of miss out on what we might see as a more sort of middle or meso level, which is the relationships that enable people to move, the relationships that encourage people to move, and the kinds of close circle of friends and family that kind of keep people connected in a way to their roots, but also enable them to settle into a new society. So it's looking at those relationships between people and how those relationships map onto different geographical locations. So that's always been something that's fascinated me. And as a migrant myself in London, it kind of had a personal resonance with my own experiences as well.
Now, you've talked to a lot of Irish people in your research with migration stories from the 30s onwards. But as I mentioned, you've also spoken to Polish, Caribbean, African migrants to London, creating a set of oral history interviews. Are there commonalities in terms of these networks of Irish, Polish, Caribbean and African migrants?
Yeah, so I published a book back in 2023 called, very imaginatively, Social Networks and Migration. And in that book, I brought together research that I'd been doing for the last 20 years, looking at different migrant groups in London, as you said, from different continents around the world, including the Irish. And what I was trying to do partly through that book was to look at kind of common experiences, because I think, especially from an Irish context, we've tended to research Irish migration pretty much in a silo, just looking at the experiences of Irish migrants. But when you situate Irish migrants alongside other migrants from the same historical period, then you really begin to see shared experiences. So looking at Irish migrants who arrived in Britain in the 50s and 60s and comparing their stories to particularly migrants from the Caribbean who arrived in London at the same time, we see so many shared experiences, so many commonalities that enable us to understand what is specific to each group, but also what is shared. And one of the things that I found fascinating was looking at accommodation, for example, and how Irish and Caribbean migrants often experienced similar challenges in finding rented accommodation in cities like London in the 50s and 60s. And of course, we immediately think of those infamous signs, no blacks, no Irish, no dogs. And one of the things that I found really so revealing was I deliberately didn't ask my participants about those signs because I didn't want to kind of lead the witness, if I can use that expression. I didn't want to put words into their mouths. So it fascinated me when I was asking the Caribbean migrants and the Irish migrants about experiences of looking for accommodation, how they brought up their own stories of seeing those signs. And obviously you'd expect the Irish to mention those signs, but it really struck me very powerfully when I heard Caribbean participants that I was interviewing also saying that they had seen those signs, no Irish, no blacks, no dogs. So again, we can see how groups from very different parts of the world arriving in London at the same time often had very similar experiences. And I think that's what we gain by looking across different migrant groups.
Now, migration has played a huge part in Irish history. It still does, obviously, to a much lesser extent now. But the stories that we mostly hear about are the stories of men, which is bizarre because certainly in the 19th and I think in the 20th century, there were as many female migrants as there were male migrants. There were as many single female migrants as there were single male migrants. So what difference does it make when we look at migration through the experiences of women, which you have largely done in this book? Irish nurses in the NHS in oral history, because most of the people you talk to, I think 43 out of 45 are female.
Yes, so in fact, for much of the 20th century, there were more women migrants leaving Ireland than men. So if we look at census data from 1926 to 1936, we see that there were 95,000 women left the Irish Free State compared to 75,000 men. So a significant majority of migrants at that time were women. And similarly, if we look at the 40s and 50s, we again see that every year, approximately 14,000 women were leaving Ireland, comparison to 10,000 men. So significantly more women than men. And the other interesting feature about Irish women migrants, which is different from many other countries in the 20th century, was that these women were very young. They were mainly teenagers and in their early 20s. And they were leaving as single women. They were not leaving as part of family groups. So they were very much workers. They were women, young, single, unmarried, childless women who were going particularly to Britain in the mid to late 20th century to work. So very, very significant story there that really needs to be told and was not told for a very long time. And it's really only in the last 20 to 25 years that that story of Irish women's migration and the huge numbers of Irish women migrating has started to become better known.
I'm assuming that Irish women had very good reasons to want to leave the, as it was, the Irish Free State in the 1930s and then the Irish Republic in the 1940s and 50s.
Yes, and in fact, this was a very lively source of debate at the time. I've done a lot of archival newspaper research, and in the 1930s, there was a very famous journalist who worked for the Irish Independent named Gertrude Gaffney. I really think Gertrude Gaffney is a historical character that warrants a lot more research because she was really a sort of a pioneer in investigative journalism of the time. And she wrote a whole series of articles in the 1930s in the Irish Independent about what was called the girl emigrant problem. And she went to London and Liverpool and she did proper investigative journalism, understanding why so many young, very young, teenage Irish girls were leaving Ireland at that time and then what was happening to them when they arrived in large British cities. And then into the 50s, you know, bishops and members of the hierarchy were really having sleepless nights worrying about what was happening to these young Irish girls and really bemoaning the fact that so many Irish girls were leaving in their droves. And such was the concern about this that the Irish government actually set up a commission on emigration, which published its reports in 1955 to try to understand why all of these young women were fleeing. Ireland at a time when, you know, there was really this huge effort to kind of create this traditional Irish society with kind of De Valera's cosy homesteads, something that tens of thousands of Irish young women were rejecting and leaving. And I think what this really shows to us is the active agency of Irish women, because I think all too often we have a tendency to assume that the Catholic Church was all powerful, that the Irish state was all powerful, and that somehow Irish women were very oppressed and controlled and passive. And in fact, what we see is a much more complicated picture, that Irish women were actively making the decision to reject that lifestyle and to leave. And nobody was stopping them from leaving. And I think this is one of the anomalies of mid-20th century Irish society, that in many ways, Irish women were constrained and controlled. They were denied many rights and a lot of independence, as we know. But one thing that they were never denied was the ability to pack their bags and go. And so that was like a safety valve in a way, that when it all got too much, Irish women just took the boat and left in their tens of thousands. So I've always been fascinated by that as an Irish woman who also left Ireland initially in the 80s, then again in the 1990s on Slattery's bus. I remember getting Slattery's bus from Cork in the late 1980s and heading off to London. So I suppose one of the reasons I've been so drawn to that historical story is because it also reflects my own personal story too.
And thousands of those who went did so to become nurses in the UK. And the National Health Service, from the time of its inception, which was 1948, actively ran a very energetic recruitment campaign in Ireland, didn't it?
Yes. So this is something that we've talked about in our new book, Irish Nurses in the NHS, An Oral History, which I co-authored with Gráinne MacPolan and Neha Doshi. And in that book, we've interviewed, as you said, 45 Irish nurses. And yeah, it's a fascinating account of how the NHS actively came to Ireland recruiting from 48 onwards. Advertisements were placed in Irish newspapers, and we've got a brilliant picture of an ad that was in the Cork Examiner in 1949, which very, very clearly outlined the attractions of going to train and work in the NHS at that time, the pay, the conditions, the accommodation in the nurse's home. So it was very enticing to leave Ireland and go and train. And in addition to placing advertisements in newspapers and on the radio, recruiters actually physically came over and they would book a room in a hotel and they would conduct interviews. So they were actually coming to Ireland, not just to big cities, but to small towns around the country, to recruit teenagers, 17 and 18 year olds, to go over to hospitals across Britain and train as nurses.
And one of the chapters is a very, very interesting chapter. It's devoted to the experience of being Irish in Britain as an NHS nurse. And the chapter title is fascinating. You're OK, even though you're Irish. So I suppose my question is, what kind of prejudices did they face when they arrived in the UK?
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier in my previous book, Irish migrants, Polish, Caribbean migrants arriving in Britain in the 50s and 60s, they did encounter a huge amount of prejudice. And yeah, a lot has been written about that. That's not necessarily a new story. But what we really wanted to explore in this book is how nurses, who were very respected workers, healthcare professionals, who were providing a vital service to patients, how even they could also experience this kind of anti-Irish prejudice, this kind of discrimination, particularly in the 70s, 80s and early 90s, around the time of the IRA bombings. And so this was a story that I don't think is widely known. And we were very privileged that these nurses trusted us with these stories. They were not easy stories to tell. They were not easy stories to hear about how relationships, and maybe this kind of goes back to networks again, about how relationships with patients, with colleagues that you'd been working with over an extended period, people that you knew, could suddenly turn against you because your Irishness kind of became the dominant aspect of your identity. The fact that you were wearing a uniform, that you were a nurse, somehow became less significant than the fact that in that moment you were Irish at a time when being Irish was being part of a suspect community. And nurses talked very powerfully about how patients would say, "I do not want you looking after me now because of what your kind or your people or your crowd are doing, blowing people up and planting bombs." So the nurses became kind of guilty by association. And instead of being seen as healthcare providers, they were somehow perceived as threats.
One of the things that was I found fascinating was that certainly in a few instances, when you talked, and particularly I think to some of the older nurses, they would start off by saying, no, we didn't experience any problems, we didn't experience any prejudice. But as they talked, and as they began to recall, I suppose, aspects and elements of their lives, it emerged that they did have problems.
Yeah, so in a way that's not entirely surprising, and I suppose this relates to the whole research methodology of oral history, because oral history is about getting people to open up and tell their stories, and oral history is, at its essence, storytelling. And particularly when you're interviewing older people, and this is something I've done a lot over the last 25 years, when you're interviewing older people, they often have a tendency to look upon the past through rose-tinted glasses. And I don't mean that in any kind of negative or disparaging way. I think we all like to feel that, you know, we've done good things in our lives, that we've had good times in our lives. And then when you're being interviewed by somebody, especially when somebody is putting a tape recorder in front of you, you want to kind of focus on the positive. You want to talk about the nice things. And so initially, I suppose, when you're interviewing somebody, particularly an older person, about their lives, there's a tendency for them to focus on the positive. And you want that. You want this to be an opportunity for people to celebrate their lives and to celebrate the achievements and the successes of their lives. But then it takes a while to build up that sort of rapport and that trust where people can then begin to talk about maybe the not so nice things that have happened to them during their lives. But as a researcher, you're always trying to balance that with the positive. And one of the things that I always try to do in conducting oral history research is to begin with the positive and to end with the positive. So you kind of leave the interview with sort of a positive, like, what are you most proud of? What do you feel are the best achievements in your life? But somewhere in the middle of the interview, you can see if the person is comfortable and relaxed enough and trusting enough to then share perhaps some of the darker moments in their lives. Now, some people will do that spontaneously, but other people, it might take them a while to kind of get into that. And it's something you always have to be sensitive about, because it may be a difficult experience for them to talk about. It may be painful. It may be very sad. And you don't just want to leave the person then feeling very upset at the end of the interview. I always would hope that an oral history interview would be a positive experience. But nonetheless, it might mean kind of asking people to talk about those negative experiences as well. But I always try to do it in a very sensitive way.
Do migration histories like these, oral histories, help us to understand the present?
Well, the first thing I would say about that, Miles, is that oral history is always framed by the present. Because when you're interviewing people in the here and now, they are not kind of a living record of the past. They are not like a snapshot of the past.
It's not archive.
It's not an archive, exactly. People that you're talking to, so say, for example, I'm interviewing an 80-year-old Caribbean man or an 80-year-old Irish man about something that happened in the 50s, You know, I'm asking them to remember something that happened when they were a very, very young person. And of course, their memory of that experience is entirely framed by everything that's gone on in between. So it is a memory, but it's a memory that's filtered through all the intervening life experiences. So, of course, you have to treat oral history in a very particular way. It's not an archive, as you say. It's a living memory. I think it's enormously valuable because these are stories of the past, but they are not snapshots of the past. And there's a very funny, if I may indulge, there's a very funny experience in when Gráinne MacPolan and I were doing the oral history interviews. We interviewed three women separately, several weeks apart. But these were three women who were friends and who had all trained as nurses together. And the first one we interviewed, she started to describe her very first impression upon arriving in the hospital in South London. And she said, I was in the taxi and the taxi was approaching the hospital and I could see coming up on the right this brand new block of white buildings. And I thought, oh, that's lovely. That's a brand new hospital. But then all of a sudden, the taxi driver started to indicate into the left. And I said to the taxi driver, sorry, I think the hospital is there on the right. And the taxi driver said, no, no, that's not the hospital. That's a block of flats. The hospital is here on the left. And the taxi turned into what our participant, Orla, described as this old, decrepit, grey, Victorian hospital. So I thought, oh, that's a fantastic story. That's really vivid. Anyway, about a week later, we were interviewing one of her friends. And the next thing, here comes the story again. Well, my brother drove me to the hospital and my brother was driving along the road and I could see this beautiful white, shiny building on the right. And then suddenly my brother turned the car into the left to this old, decrepit Victorian hospital. And I thought, wow, this from an oral history perspective is absolutely fascinating. And then would you believe it, a few days later, we interviewed the third friend. And here comes the story again, word for word. The bright, brand new block on the right and the hospital, the old, decrepit Victorian building on the left. Now, what does this tell us about oral history? Does this mean that these three women had somehow colluded with each other and made up this story? No, this is what we really would describe as a collective narrative, because these were three friends who had spent quite a lot of time together over the years. And they had obviously told this story together. They had honed it. It had become kind of more detailed and more graphic with the retelling. And it had become a shared memory. So each of those women firmly remembered this experience in a word-for-word way. But clearly this was something that they had shared many times. And that's not to say that they were making it up or they were exaggerating, but this is what oral history is. It's a memory and sometimes it's a shared memory. And that's why we should be cautious about interviewing too many people who know each other, because there's almost a kind of groupthink phenomenon that can go on. And so it's good to also try to get a diversity of participants. And that's why I'd go back to that experience I mentioned earlier when I was doing the research with the older Irish men and the Caribbean men, and they started talking about seeing the signs, no blacks, no Irish, no dogs. What fascinated me about that oral history was that you had completely different people who had never met each other, who had never spoken to each other before, sharing such a similar experience and such a similar memory. So that's a kind of long answer, Miles, to your question. But I think oral history is immensely valuable. But we also have to be aware that it is based on memory.
Got to be careful, definitely. Yeah. And the book we've been talking about is Irish Nurses in the NHS, an Oral History by Louise Ryan, Gráinne MacPolan and Neha Doshi. It's published by Four Courts Press. It's a story that'll be familiar to so many Irish families of leaving home, making a life abroad, doing hard, often unglamorous work that kept, in this case, hospitals and I suppose whole societies running. And as we've heard, the experiences of those Irish nurses in the NHS still have something something to say to us today in a world where migration and movement are part of so many lives. My guest is Professor Louise Ryan. Louise, many thanks for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much.